Canada's relations with the United States has some parallels with New Zealand and Australia. They're the smaller neighbour, which often gets overlooked when it comes to big international affairs. But the election of a new Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, last month could end up having a significant impact on global politics, and that's partly due to some interesting timing. The new Prime Minister's promising to legalise cannabis just ahead of an international summit on drug treaties next year. He wants Canada to take a more aggressive stance on climate change just before climate change negotiations begin in Paris later this month. And just as Russia steps into the fight against the militant Islamic fundamentalists in the Middle East, challenging United States dominance, Trudeau has halted airstrikes in the US-led campaign against Islamic State. My guest is Dr. David Diamond, the Ottawa president of the Canadian International Council and author of the book Doing the Continental, A New Canadian-American Relationship. David, good morning. Welcome.
Yes. Hi, Catherine. Great to be with you. I lived for a couple of years in New Zealand.
Oh, lovely. We have this connection with Canada. It's like a sort of a deep bond in a way, and I don't know whether it is to do with that bigger nation next door that's often a bit brasher and a bit louder, but listen, a really interesting time in your politics. This is a significant change after a decade, a very significant change of direction.
Yes, it's been an unusual, I mean, as an observer and student, it's been an unusual 9.5 years for Canada. We have a more traditional electoral system like you used to have, and the kind of electoral forces came together and made it possible for really about a core of 30% of Canadians who thought of Canada's role in the world and our domestic policies in a certain kind of way were able to maintain power in two minority governments and then a majority government for 9.5 years. And by the end of this period, I got to tell you, in October, the pent-up desire by the 70% of Canadians who was like, what has been going on? Is this absolutely enough? Was so great that we had two political parties vying from the progressive left, if you like, and when the momentum went with the Liberals, it went very dramatically, and they got a majority government. And even the other progressive party, the people who were so disappointed because they'd led in the polls for a long while, were like, priority one was changing the direction of Canada. So that's kind of the mood that a lot of Canadians were in October.
Mind you, after a long stint in government like that, the tide goes out very quickly. People just fatigue, full stop, in many ways. And it had been a long stint under the Conservative government of Stephen Harper. We're interested, though. I mean, the other, of course, aspect that makes it such an interesting time is that this is a return to a very famous name and almost the only sort of dynasty, is it fair to say, the only sort of dynasty in politics in Canada?
Yeah, I guess the only successful one, and without getting too much into the details of our politics, that would be true. Justin Trudeau, I mean, right up until the last, it was a 3-month-long election, and right up until the last month, he was perceived as not ready, not at all like his father, who was so masterful. So it's a funny kind of dynasty where the son, people have got their fingers crossed to a certain extent and going, we've just given you a significant majority. You reassured us in the last month of the campaign that we would give it to you. And so far he's got a lovely touch and some of the charm of his dad. It's true, but it took Canadians a long time to start to see it in a big way.
Let's look at where we're coming from today, which is that there's some reasonably significant conversations going on at the moment at a global level. And I mentioned earlier, sometimes New Zealand gets overlooked relative to its neighbour, that the US sometimes overshadows Canada. But actually, surprisingly, the sort of moral authority sometimes can almost outstrip the size of these two countries. I mean, New Zealand has just finished a stint at the head of the Security Council. Surprisingly, sometimes both can punch above their weight. And I think the other thing that's often very significant is that, particularly in times of war, US-led, British-led consortia are very keen to have every single name on the list that they can, Canada and New Zealand included. So shall we start with what is happening at the moment in the IS campaign and the decision that's been made already to stop airstrikes? Was that well signalled by the new Canadian PM?
Yeah, that is something that both opposition parties had promised to do. As an observer, I think it was perhaps less ideological in how it was perceived. There was arguably a case that it's a serious situation. ISIS has got to be stopped in its tracks and rolled back. And the way at this moment you're going to do that is in part by airstrikes. So I'm not sure as many Canadians were resolutely concerned that those airstrikes stop. But it was a promise that the Trudeau government had made, and they're doing exactly that.
And when it comes to relations with the United States, again, because it was well signalled as a pledge, was that understood? In other words, how was this received by the U.S.?
Oh, well, Obama and Trudeau, in their first conversation, Obama kind of, as a matter of course, said, look, we'd like you to continue. I interviewed Bill Clinton for my book on Canada-U.S. relations and asked him how Canada could make its best contribution, and he specifically said, don't just think about sending another 6 fighter jets. Canada, perhaps a bit like New Zealand, or very much like New Zealand, doesn't have a colonial legacy, and you can do things in the world which draw on that unique contribution, and then you can bring that to me in the White House and have an influence both on American thinking, and because you're more influential with us in Washington, be more influential with the other countries around you. So I think there's a sense that we can contribute without sending warplanes as a kind of knee-jerk reaction to American requests, and therefore Obama's kind of less inclined to go, oh, we've been betrayed by the Canadians by removing those planes.
Also, what is the contribution that does remain? Because, as I said, often what the US and others are looking for is a sense of legitimacy by having a lot of countries signed up. And in effect, Canada is still making a contribution.
Well, one of the things, Catherine, for Canada's relationship with the United States and having lived in New Zealand, and I think maybe in New Zealand there's a sense that, wow, that's a big and important relationship, but there's so much depth and breadth to the Canada-U.S. relationship. We're managing a 5,000-kilometer border, including with Alaska. There's so many trade issues and environmental and energy issues that we don't really go offside with the Americans because we remove, 6 fighter jets from a theater.
Understood. I want to come back to the pipeline and some of those issues you're talking about in a minute. But let's stay with the international politics. Canada's pledging to evacuate refugees from Syria and bring them to Canada. This is such a sensitive issue at the moment. Most countries in Europe are looking to try and limit their exposure to an overwhelming problem. Is Canada trying to set some kind of a precedent here?
Well, that came up as a big issue in the election, and it was a lightning rod that I think reinforced a lot of people's view that Harper was hard-hearted and that he was very much in measurable terms dragging his feet in allowing Syrian refugees to come to Canada for a bunch of reasons that one could imagine. And Trudeau made the most aggressive promises as a kind of counter to that image of saying, come on, there are 5 million refugees, that we should, as Canada, step up, as we did with what sometimes are described as Vietnamese boat people, and in this case, bring in 25,000 Syrian refugees before Christmas. And I've just been today on a NATO exercise in Portugal and talking with military folks, and they're saying, we're ready to organize ourselves to bring these 25,000 Syrians to Canada, but we don't know quite how we're going to do it. I hope I'm not letting out any secrets. And my sense is the government has got so much on its plate that they're not going to try and bring those 25,000 to Canada before the new year.
Let's look at another matter that's getting close and is going to be a very big effort as well, which is the 196 countries getting together at the end of this month in Paris to try and seriously launch a new deal on climate. How would you compare the bids, if you like, or the commitment, opening commitments that Canada put forward a few months ago with what the incoming government is likely to offer? What is its position going to be going into Paris?
Well, this is a really big one for Canadians because there was a sense that the old government and arguably the reality that they really were almost denying climate change, and certainly climate change is something that should be addressed. So it was very important for the Trudeau campaign and now government to coalesce around this issue. So as someone who's normally living in Canada and very exposed to the debate, and we just had the new cabinet announced this week. There's a minister for environment and climate change as you know, one title of the new ministry. But in actual substance, and doing a little research on what it's going to mean, is it's such a big generic conference in Paris at the end of this month and the beginning of December. And I've asked some lawyers in our foreign affairs department how, because I actually knew you were going to ask me this question. I said, what does it mean? What will I answer? And the response was, it's not going to make much difference. They're going to go with all 10 Canadian premiers. So it's going to be a big delegation compared to Harper, who would have sent a director general from the foreign ministry. But what impact it's going to have at the conference, and this is the takeaway, very little from what research I did in trying to get ready to answer that question.
The conference itself is only ever going to be a starting point for really hard, detailed negotiations and deal-making. But the significance of the conference, I think, is who turns up and what their attitude is and what they say, and also a sense of a broad sort of plan for negotiations to come out the other end. Are people seeing a shift, at least in that approach by the government, or is it too early to say whether there'll be any practicable shift?
Oh, well, there's one really significant element, Catherine, and that is, you know, we have 10 provinces and 3 territories, and we're very devolved, and in our constitution, provinces have really significant and important jurisdictional areas of responsibility. And what was happening after nine and a half years of the Harper government is the federal authorities were showing no leadership in coordinating what some provinces like Ontario and British Columbia, big, important, dynamic provinces, could be significant countries in their own right, modestly said. We're doing things, but now Trudeau is saying, let me help lead this and let me benefit from the richness that some provinces have been developing and responding to climate change.
The other international matter, the United States, going back a fair way now, launched the international war on drugs. There's a lot of debate, increasingly countries independently beginning to decriminalise, if not legalise, recreational drugs. And indeed, I think even in some states in the United States, that is happening now. Again, is this a very different approach under the new leadership in Canada? And exactly what is the Prime Minister saying?
Yeah, now that's an interesting one. Trudeau got into a lot of trouble early on as Liberal leader, long before the election, of talking about legalizing marijuana, and was ridiculed for it, as you could sort of imagine, as a younger person and being far too liberal by an older conservative prime minister. And so he didn't move away, Trudeau, from that position during the election. But as an observer, we are not hearing very much about it. And, you know, a new government with a majority mandate after almost 10 years and a really different vision, be a bit like having a Labour government after a National government. They've got so much on their plate that my read, and it's sincere, is that on marijuana, nothing very much is going to happen very fast.
There's a summit on drug treaties, I think, at the UN next year, and that's seldom a fast-moving process, is it? Let's look then, apart from the global, let's look at internally what the really big issues are, and I think you've hinted at them. They're the practical things. I know there's been a lot of stress, a lot of debate over the Keystone XL pipeline. Just remind us of what that story is about, some of the big energy issues and border issues.
Yeah, well, if it's not too self-promotional, I wrote doing the continental new Canada-U.S. relationship. One of the points I make in the chapter on energy is we've had no debate about pipelines, and the book came out 4 years ago. And since then, it's almost all we have some days in the newspaper is debate about pipelines. I'm sure my book had very little to do with it, but there's a pipeline to the north that would run through Canada and a lot of issues through native tribal areas, and then the very vulnerable North Pacific coast. So that gateway project is the least likely to go ahead. Keystone XL, which would take bitumen, which is the heavier oil from the tar sands, refine it, because there's huge refining capacity in the Gulf of Mexico, and it's very expensive to build refineries. So one of the arguments is Canada, as a resource-based country, really should be doing more of its processing of natural resources in Canada, so we should build refineries in Canada and not send the bitumen straight down to the big refineries in the Gulf of Mexico. But generally, the thrust is that the pipeline would get built if Obama wasn't using it as a political issue, because he can't go offside with his base, just as the Republicans have a base. His base is very keen, including some very influential funders who throw billions of dollars, or billionaires, and throwing tens or if not hundreds of millions of dollars at Democratic causes. He can't move forward and approve the pipeline, because when it crosses an international boundary, then it becomes the State Department and ultimately the president's decision. So that's not going anywhere, the sense is. But then we have a third pipeline, which is the Canada East pipeline, which would go to New Brunswick. And many people feel that that is a real nation-building project, the way you would build a transcontinental railroad. And that we are, this is a long answer, but we are importing from places like Venezuela oil right up to the Ottawa River, which is to say Quebec East. If we were shipping that oil through Canada and then refining it in the Maritime provinces and shipping it out, that would probably be the most sensible thing to do. But there's a lot of opposition in Canada, because leave the carbon in the ground. So that's the big debate going forward, is probably how to deal with the Canada East pipeline.
Thank you, Dr. David Dimitz, the Ottawa president of the Canadian International Council.